Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I will be your host. And today, we are talking with Brian Adams from Excelsior Capital. How's it going, Brian?
Hey, doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Good. So, Brian, why don't you just tell the listeners a little bit about yourself to start?
I am a New Yorker who married a Nashville girl. We met in school, lived in the Northeast for a bit. We both went to grad school up in Boston. My wife, like every other Nashville woman in history, wanted to move back home. So we relocated to Nashville 15 years ago. And my wife's family has a single family office based here. And it was through joining the family that I got exposure to private equity, venture capital, commercial real estate, et cetera. And I practiced law for a number of years, and then I started the company 11 years ago now. And we are a commercial real estate syndication platform. And we raise capital on a deal-by-deal basis from a network of individuals, families, boutique wealth management firms. And we try to do three things: give people access to direct co-investment opportunities, achieve a double-digit cash-on-cash yield that we distribute monthly. And then we do everything we can to leverage all the tax benefits that come from direct real estate ownership and pass those benefits through to our investors themselves.
So let's talk a little bit about the commercial real estate market. I mean, this is, you know, we talk a lot about the show, about residential properties and things like that, but commercial doesn't get as much attention. So I wanted to bring you on to kind of talk about that. So let's talk about commercial real estate. So can you just, I guess, to start, define commercial real estate?
It can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. It's a squishy term that's a big tent. But for us, it means office, industrial, what we call flex, which is a retail or office usage, typically in the front half of the building, and then some kind of industrial distribution usage in the back half of the building. Think of that single story product you see near airports. And then we do some medical office as well. So the continuum of commercial can include a lot of different things, all the way to, you know, self-storage, data center, et cetera. But that's kind of the universe that we live in, food groups that I just mentioned.
You know, there's obviously a lot of different areas that you could focus on in commercial real estate. So why have you focused on those four?
What I mentioned before about trying to achieve that yield profile. I mean, our investors come to us because they're looking for some kind of cash on cash passive income stream. And in our opinion, to be rewarded for the risk and illiquidity you take participating in a syndication or private equity in general, we think you need to be somewhere that double digit cash on cash range. And so when you're coming at it from that perspective, you're really focused on cap rate and price per square foot. And we think those groups that I mentioned have the best risk adjusted return profile. Now, you could certainly go do an Amazon Class A distribution center deal, but your return is probably going to be 2 or 3%. And then on the same token, you could do an opportunistic retail deal and your IRR might be, you know, 30 or 40. But for us and what we're trying to achieve and the problems we're trying to solve within our investor network, these asset classes and these groups that I mentioned are how we can get there without taking too much risk or too much leverage.
Yeah. So let's describe that, because I think, you know, real estate right now, I mean, real estate's obviously changed a lot in the last few years. You know, if I kind of look at different ways to invest, like you said, there's kind of low risk and then there's really the high risk. But, you know, assets pretty much all over the world have become really expensive because there's just cash floating around, needs to go somewhere. So how are you able to get, you know, double digit yields from commercial real estate when pretty much yields across the board are not really generating that? Like, how are you able to do that?
We've had to go down market in terms of pricing. 3-4 years ago, if we were having this conversation, I'd say that our sweet spot was $15 to $20 million acquisitions. Today, it's very much $7 to $12 million. And so we've had to go down in pricing just because, to your point, there's so much liquidity in the system, so much private equity stockpiling cash that has driven cap rates down across the board and pushed it through the whole ecosystem. And then we go to some markets that for a whole host of reasons institutional private equity won't go to. So we're focused on, you know, growing secondary markets. These are smaller cities that maybe don't qualify for the investment committee of a larger private equity group. So smaller deal size and doing a lot of homework on some different markets that we can approach.
Let's kind of talk about a few things here. So we're talking about going down market. You know, I've heard a lot about this over the years of kind of like the middle market, if you will. Like there's these gaps where you're too small for the institutions, but too big for the individual investors. So what does that range fall in your mind right now?
Yeah, and I'll preface this by saying there's an old adage in real estate that I think is true after doing this for 11 years. The amount of work and brain damage it takes to do a $100 million deal is pretty similar to a $10 million deal, but there's different pricing premiums involved. Yeah, and a couple of years ago, if you had asked me this question, I would have said $25 million was when you start getting, you know, larger groups involved. And now, depending on the market, I think it's more like 20 or maybe even 15 million, where you get allocator funds and private equity groups involved, or maybe a sponsor with a backer. So, you know, we've continued to try to be competitive by going smaller in deal size and not suffering from style drift. But I think once you get in that $20 to $25 million acquisition price, you're looking at a fully run, you know, double blind auction process, fully marketed with a pretty legitimate group like a CBRE of the world. Once you get that many eyes on that deal, you know, it's going to be competitive.
That's good to know, because I know, I don't know, maybe it was 7 years ago, we were looking at something at a property that was, I want to say it was maybe in the $20 million range, great yield. And no one was buying it, not because it wasn't a good deal. It was like 80% government leased, but it was too expensive for the area and it was too small for the big guys. So it just kind of sat there.
There are still inefficient pockets of the market, but again, and I think it's hard for US-based investors to understand this, but you've got to have some perspective here, because if you're a German pension plan or insurance company, and you're getting 100 or 200 negative basis point return on your bond portfolio, a 2-cap or a 3-cap paying all cash looks pretty attractive relative to your fixed income portfolio. And that just drives cap rates down across the spectrum. And another thing that I think people struggle with and we have to remind ourselves of is, because there's been this run-up in the market, call it up 20% since last year, institutional groups have to reallocate because they can't be overexposed to the stock market. And that means they're going to be allocating more to alternatives and more to real assets. And so that's why you're going to see more and more of these big behemoth private equity groups coming out with blockbuster fund sizes, because they know the institutional groups have to reallocate and redistribute those percentages. And that impacts, you know, the entire ecosystem of commercial real estate as well.
It's a great point. I mean, one thing that I've noticed in looking at these institutional portfolios, you know, these endowments, these, you know, college, you know, these colleges have these enormous pools of money that they invest. And I've noticed the percentages for private equity, mostly alternatives, have been climbing quite a bit in the last few years. You attribute most of that to the stock market, or is it just mainly people are seeing better opportunities in the private equity space?
Yeah, I mean, private equity's outperformed over the last 10 or 20 years, generally speaking. You know, as these groups have longer or larger defined benefit liabilities, they need to continually reach for return. And the way that I explain to people is, you know, if you're a family office, which has an endowment style mindset, you're trying to maintain a quality of life across multiple generations. And in order to do that, you need to assume that inflation is 2 or 3%, that your overhead, right, your operating expenses to maintain that quality of life are 4 to 5%. And then you've got an exponentially growing family, right? Two kids. In order to do that, when you add that all together, you need to be clipping 15 to 20% returns annually. Now, you're not going to get them every year, but that's the type of return profile and risk profile you need to be running in order to do that correctly. And the only way to do that is to go to alternatives and private equity.
Yeah, that's actually a great perspective. I've never heard anybody describe it that way. Not only just to keep the capital growing, but also the exponentially growing family size. Which
mm-hmm. it's very challenging. That's why, you know, the shirt sleeves adage we hear a lot. Some of it has to do with bad behavior and risk taking, but a lot of it is just math. It's hard to outperform consistently and generate that type of alpha. I think it's unrealistic for most people.
I totally agree. I think although I would say the third generation tends to be more behavioral than math based from what I've seen. You know, the first generation makes it, the second really works hard, and then the third generation, they tend to be different.
If you sat down and talked to a lot of these folks who had a liquidity event, sold to private equity, you know, after taxes, net of fees, after 10 or 20 years, they'd probably rather have their operating company. Because it's just impossible to replicate that type of alpha generation in the public markets. And then you have to become an expert overnight in the private markets. And if your business was selling Christmas trees and you had a huge, you know, timber portfolio, you can't become a hedge fund expert overnight like that. Or you have to pay up a lot for experts and that just eats your overhead. So right. It's a very challenging space.
Yeah, actually, we just had the founder of Tiger 21 on talking a lot about those, you know, entrepreneurs do not make good investors, right? It's a very different mindset being an entrepreneur and being an investor. It's almost like the exact opposite mindset you have to have, you know, from risk-taking to basically wealth preservation. Very, very different perspectives.
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, oftentimes, I think entrepreneurs generally have three chapters to their journey. You know, chapter one is the adventure and the call to action. Chapter two is some kind of abyss moment where things are really dicey and it may not work. And then chapter three is kind of the redemption and the success. And oftentimes in America, we just focus on one and three. We kind of skip over two and the messy middle. But you've got to realize that these people take, the fact patterns are pretty similar. These entrepreneurs and wealth creators take massive risk, massive concentration and leverage to get there. It's hard and it's not for everybody. And it's certainly not the way that institutional investors think about building a portfolio.
Yeah, it's funny you say the three chapters. That's the hero's journey they talk Correct. About in movies, right?
Right. You know? Yeah. Joseph Campbell.
That's good. So getting back to the real estate though. So let's go over a few other things you said because I want to clarify for the listeners. So you talked about secondary markets. So what is a secondary market?
Sure. An MSA, which is kind of a metropolitan area of 500,000 to a million people total. And MSAs can be really wonky definitions, you know, some, especially in the Midwest and the Southeast, there's no geophysical barriers in a lot of these markets. So sprawl can be very big. And brokers will call MSAs pretty egregious numbers, in my opinion, but 500,000 to a million people outside of the top 10 traditional gateway markets. So if you think about New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Miami, et cetera. Those are kind of the traditional gateway class A markets. These are groups that are in the middle, a step below that, but they're still kind of growing places where people are moving, where they have good infrastructure, good ecosystems, good industry drivers. And we focus on those secondary markets in the Southeast and the Midwest.
Can you give me some examples of what those are? Some of those.
Yeah. Markets? And I'll throw a caveat on that Texas we just put in there because it's its own thing, but we include it. So right now we're focused on opportunities in Kansas City, Kansas, El Paso, Texas, West Palm Beach. So those type of markets are where we're spending a lot of time and effort right now.
What do you think of your own home area of Tennessee? I've heard a lot of good things about that.
It's tremendous. The growth is incredible. Unfortunately, it's become an institutional market and it's very hard to find value here. Given the growth trajectory, it's very much a developer's market. So buying in-place stable cash flow is exceedingly expensive. So we run about 2.7 million square feet total in our portfolio today, roughly 20,000 square feet in Nashville. We sold pretty much everything that we had and very difficult market to enter considering our risk profile and what we're trying to achieve from a yield perspective. But a great place to live.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things, especially in the residential side. A lot of investors are buying up property there and starting to hear things about Kentucky too now, which is interesting. That's Not sure what the growth is there, but it sounds like there's a ton of growth there. Is that what you're seeing as well?
Yeah, same thing. I mean, we've been active in Louisville. We've certainly looked at Lexington. Yeah, I think I'm not a residential investor, but given the population growth and job growth here, and really COVID's accelerated a lot of those demographic shifts that we saw playing out, I think the Sun Belt's going to continue to be a very attractive place for people to move to.
What are your thoughts on, you mentioned before demographic shifts. So let's talk about that a little bit. So what are some of the demographic shifts that you're seeing?
Sure. So millennials, which I qualify barely, but I do qualify, are now the largest generational working cohort in American history. It's about 75 million people total. And we believe, and part of our investment thesis is that Wall Street and a lot of investment folks had this concept that this generation would never get married. They would not have children. They would stay in these kind of Brooklyns and the San Franciscos of the world. And they would eat avocado toast and wear skinny jeans and never leave those markets. The reality is, because of the Great Recession, that family formation phase got pushed back 3 to 5 years, but it's starting to occur in a very real way. And increasingly, these people are making decisions about where they want to live, work, and play based on cost of living, quality of life, access to single family homes, and access to education for their children. In sum, they want the same childhood for their kids that they had growing up. So like most generations in the past, they want to go back to the suburbs, have access to childcare, education, as well as a yard, et cetera. So we saw this playing out on the employee side anecdotally from a lot of our friends in New York City and on the West Coast looking to relocate to Big Ten or Big 12 or SEC country. And even pre-COVID, we started seeing this play out with, you know, Amazon's HQ2 search highlighted a lot of markets that people were surprised by. And increasingly, you're seeing corporate relocations take place because even with the recession now kind of we're coming out of it, the biggest challenge for a lot of employers is going to be accessing and maintaining human capital and that workforce, that employee force. And they're going to where their employees are based now. And I think, frankly, COVID has just provided political cover for these groups to make moves that they've wanted to make for a long time. And if you look at the budget situation and the incoming tax regimes in California, New York, and elsewhere, they're going to continue to punish ultra-high net worth individuals and their respective companies for being based in these markets. And they're mobile now. And you're going to continue to see these corporate relocations take place to the interior Midwest, as well as the Sun Belt region.
So let's talk about that a little bit before we get into COVID. But, you know, I mean, if you look at these trends, I mean, obviously that generation is a lot more technologically savvy and things are a lot more virtual now. Why are people needing to move to these areas? Why not just work virtually?
You're not going to stay in New York or California if the tax regime is pernicious against you. And I think COVID has allowed people to realize that, you know, they don't necessarily need to be based in Wall Street or Silicon Valley in order to do their job. And on the investment side or the employer side, they've likewise realized, well, we can have a distributed workforce across multiple markets, and we can save a lot on our corporate tax overhead. I think that's one part of it. In terms of why you still need to be in one of these hubs, we all suffer from recency bias. And initially with the pandemic, you saw things coming out from Twitter and others saying that everyone's going to work from home forever. Well, about 6 to 9 months in, people started seeing that their workforce was depressed, feeling isolated, and really struggling to be creative, dynamic, and anything that required collaborative group teamwork just wasn't working. So I think there's still going to be a real return and need for an in-person experience in order to be competitive in today's workforce and marketplace. I don't think everyone needs to be at the mothership necessarily in Seattle to make it happen. But I do think people realize that we need some kind of connectivity here in person. And also, you have to remember, and I think employees are starting to realize this, that even if you are a hardcore coder, software engineer, and you don't need to ever talk to anybody in person, Facebook is not going to pay you the same if you never come to the office and you live in Idaho versus if you live in Austin and you're engaged with executives on a daily basis. It's just how it's going to work.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about COVID because I think that's a big part of this. Last year was a big change that a lot of people weren't expecting. But then a lot of companies actually, I mean, Microsoft, Facebook, I mean, there were a few companies, Google, that I forget which one said, they said you can permanently live wherever you want. You don't have to ever come back.
It was Twitter, and they've since walked that back.
Okay. Yeah. What's interesting is you started to see people flee in mass from Silicon Valley, from New York. You know, I have some people I know in like Montana, and they said people are just flooding into Montana, you know, Lake Tahoe, like these homes are just getting gobbled up by people from like San Francisco that just had to get out. And I wonder if that's going to change because San Francisco is one of the most expensive places you could live in the U.S. You know, there was always this question of when is that shift going to change? Because there, you know, I had a friend who wanted to live there and he got offered a job and the salary was pretty good, but you still couldn't afford to live there on that salary. So yeah, there's this challenge in these high-end areas of being able to afford to live there. So how do you see all that kind of changing, or do you? I mean, obviously COVID has changed a lot, but you think it might change back?
I think the Northeast and the West Coast are in a secular decline. If you look at the budget situation, the only real option they have is to increase taxes and decrease services, which will just cause more and more people to leave, which is a bit of a death spiral. Now, there are natural cycles to these things. I think what that will do is allow them to become affordable again to young entrepreneurs. It'll take 5 or 10 years for those markets to come back, but I think they will. But for the foreseeable future, I think it's going to be a very challenging place to be an entrepreneur, to be a business owner, and you'll continue to see folks leave. Now, if you look at the census data that just got distributed this morning, I mean, these were patterns that were already well in play pre-COVID. And it's not surprising that New York lost a seat. California lost 2 seats, first time, I think, in 130 years or since they became a state. And Texas and Florida are gaining. I mean, that's not surprising to me at all.
One thing I've talked a lot about, so curious in your opinion, with a lot of different real estate investors, especially in the Boston area where I am, and you know, there's this open question of when is the real estate market going to turn? Because real estate is cyclical. There are cycles that, you know, there are booms and busts as we've seen over decades. Usually they're based on some fundamental issue in the system, you know, like the S&L crisis or 2008. But you know, when I look at stuff like that, like I look at Boston, it's probably one of the most economically diverse markets in the U.S. I mean, you've got, you know, government, you've got education, you've got hospitals, you got tech, you got biotech, you got finance. I mean, it's all over the place. And in 2008, it didn't really get hit that hard. So I look at Boston as a pretty insulated market with a lot of, you know, human capital, but it's expensive and there's no more inventory really going up. And so it's this question of like, what causes markets like that to turn if you're not adding inventory, places like Texas where you can continue to add? So how does that work? What should people be looking for in markets like that?
You know, frankly, given the Fed's posture these days and the fact that no sitting president wants to go through a full-blown recession, a naturally cyclical occurring recession, and they just use the Fed and Treasury to prevent them from occurring, I don't see any systemic issues that would cause a major downturn today, absent a full blowout of the economy. When you've got essentially free money and exceedingly cheap debt and accommodative lenders, I don't see why there would be a massive cycle that lasts, you know, traditionally, you know, 2 or 3 years. I don't think anybody's got the political will to do that anymore. Now, there'll be pockets, right? And I'm going on a bit of a limb here, but I just think that the presidents nowadays realize they can use their bully pulpit to make the Fed do what they want. And clearly what they want is to, you know, prevent naturally occurring cycles from happening anymore. That might create more massive issues in the future, but everyone just kind of wants to punt. So markets like Boston, which have meds and eds underlying them, I don't see any reason. I think they're going to continue to be expensive. I agree with you. I think the human capital there is tremendous. I think biotech is going to be a great place to be. And they've got tremendous educational resources locally, but there'll come a point where it's just the barrier to entry for an investment perspective is just going to be really challenging. And it'll be very much kind of the haves and have-nots, I think.
I think it's challenging to look and see opportunities. Then you look at these other areas. So let's get into these other parts of commercial real estate, because I think it'll be helpful to listeners to understand the differences. So you talked about kind of flex, industrial, medical. So what are the trends in industrial? Because I've heard, you know, when COVID started, you know, I heard basically industrial was the place to be. So can you talk about that a little bit?
It continues to be, I think, one of the most attractive, that and probably medical, the most attractive investment areas today, given, you know, e-commerce and just how reliant these tech companies are on the distribution networks that they use to deliver goods. You know, we all heard about kind of last mile, et cetera, but it's kind of like housing. They just can't build enough product to keep up with the demand. And so if you look at kind of where the economy is headed, we're becoming a tech-oriented services economy. I think that portends well for distribution and industrial and flex in general. And then if you look at the demographics of this aging baby boomer population, medical, especially in the Sunbelt region, I think will continue to be a very attractive place to put capital to work.
You mentioned you do office too, but do you see that as a place to really put capital now? Because, I mean, there's a lot of office that companies have decided we don't need as much office space because, you know, people can work from home even if they're coming into the office sometimes. I mean, a lot of companies are just talking about how they want to use this as an opportunity to cut costs and maybe cut office space. So how does that kind of affect, you know, what you're doing?
Yeah, it's hard to say. And it's not a cop-out answer, but if you look at office and you look at the weighted average lease term of a lot of these buildings, like our portfolio, we're talking about 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 years of lease that have to expire before these companies have to make a decision about what to do. And so because of that stability, I think it's very hard to gauge. You know, when you see these reports coming out, office is coming back or office is dead, I take them all with a grain of salt because it will take probably 10 years for this to shake out, given how long a lot of these lease terms are. Now, I do think I agree with you. A lot of corporations and employers are using this as an excuse to cut overhead. And the way we use office, I think, will change, right? Pre-COVID, 3% of the workforce worked remotely. Obviously, that'll be a bigger number moving forward. But when you look at the square footage that each employee needs or that employers think they need to provide to have a competitive workforce, this trend that we saw from 2008 to COVID, where like the WeWork model of really dense, really expensive build outs where people were hot desking, hoteling, and benching, and they were going down to 75 square feet per user. I think the trend is going to go the other way and the pendulum will swing back to more traditional office layouts of 250 to 350 square feet per user, because people will need a place to focus and get work done. And then also they'll want more flexible areas where they can collaborate, they can be creative thinking, there can be teamwork done. So you're looking at more multi-purpose type board areas. And when you put that all together, I think it's probably a wash. Now, would I invest in an office deal in Midtown Manhattan right now? No. I think there's going to be really challenging places. But I think for the most part, I think it'll probably be a massive overreaction. And if you look at the REIT market as a proxy for what investors think is going to happen with office, even in major metros, it's not quite back to what it was pre-COVID, but it's pretty close.
Brings up a good question. You mentioned REITs. Like with what you're doing, why would somebody consider kind of like syndications versus doing a REIT? Because, I mean, REITs are easily accessible, at least the publicly traded ones are, to investors. So why would somebody choose like a syndication versus like a REIT?
Sure. REITs are a poor proxy for direct real estate investment. They have exceedingly high correlation to the overall market. I think you saw that, you know, March and April of last year when the REIT market was down 40%, even though rent collection and occupancy were very high. So it doesn't diversify your exposure to stocks like true real estate does. You don't get the tax benefits that come from cost segregation analysis and accelerated depreciation, where I can give you a loss on your K-1 for year one and year two while giving you a double-digit yield. And the income levels and the yields, they're in the 3 to 5% range, depending. I just don't think that's worth it from a disadvantaged tax perspective when it's ordinary income. It's just not a viable apples to apples comparison, in my opinion. I think there's some great operators and some tremendous REIT names, and I know some folks in that space. It's just, it's not even close to the same thing as a direct real estate investment.
You mentioned the tax. I want to get into that a little bit. So you mentioned that the REITs are pretty much ordinary income and, you know, direct investment has different tax treatments. So how does that differ between those two?
Sure. So when you invest in a REIT and you're getting a 5% coupon, that distribution will be taxed as ordinary income. When you invest $100 into one of our deals, until you get that $100 back, that's a return of capital. That's not taxed. In addition, through cost segregation analysis and accelerated depreciation, I can actually push through losses to your K-1, which you can then use to offset gains elsewhere in your personal portfolio. So I can give you, you know, a 10% cash on cash yield annually, plus show a loss that you can use elsewhere. And obviously, if we hold the property for more than a year, which we would do, you get the favorable capital gains tax treatment on the back end once the property sells.
I think real estate is one of those, I mean, it's one of my favorite assets for some of the reasons that you mentioned. It's got tremendously beneficial tax treatment, amongst other things.
I have to tell people, you know, there's the adage, don't fight the Fed, which probably right, but you should also not fight the IRS. And when you look at the tax code, it's a set of incentives and disincentives to encourage certain behavior and discourage certain behavior. And it's clearly set up to encourage you to own your own home and to invest in commercial real estate.
I couldn't agree more. I think real estate is a great asset for many reasons, but that's definitely one of them. As we kind of look at, I want to ask a few more questions, we can wrap it up. You mentioned earlier kind of you like the risk-adjusted return profile of this. So when you're thinking of risk-adjusted return, how do you look at that when it comes to real estate? Because you mentioned earlier you can take a lot more risk and get 30% return versus just over double-digit returns, which are still good. But how do you kind of weigh that when you're looking at properties? Because, I mean, 30% is pretty good. So why would you kind of choose one versus the other?
And this is really a reflection of our management team and our investment style and thesis, as well as the investor base we have. Most of my folks and investor group, you know, they've already created some wealth, or they're having wealth creation within their operating company or their quote unquote day job. And they look to us to provide some current cash flow and yield and a passive coupon that they can get monthly. And I think we have, as a investing culture, misidentified what risk is. And when you deal with private equity and real estate, risk is not hitting your 10% yield. Risk is a permanent loss of capital. And that permanent loss of capital is pernicious because it takes so much more time and energy and effort to just get back to zero baseline, let alone recapturing that lost opportunity cost that you would have had if you didn't go down 30%. So for us and our style, we just don't have that risk profile. So we like stable day one cash flowing properties that aren't going to maybe have this huge IRR. But most of my folks can't take IRR to their second mortgage or to pay for college tuition. So it really comes to how we think about investing and our style and our thesis and, you know, who we're trying to serve on the investor side.
So as we wrap up here, anything that you think we haven't talked about, you think would be relevant for people to understand?
One thing that is going to be increasingly topical for folks, even if you don't have a ton of familiarity with private equity or private syndications or you know, direct commercial real estate, I think you need to realize as a market participant, you're already getting exposure to these asset classes. And so at the very minimum, you need to educate yourself about what they are and what they aren't and how they behave. Because when you look at Carlyle and Blackstone and BlackRock and your 401k, you're already getting exposure to private equity. I mean, these are big publicly traded groups that their core business is operating in these asset classes. And I think the democratization of access to alternatives and private equity is going to be a theme that we see play out over the next 10 to 20 years pretty significantly. So nothing else, you know, I'd encourage you just, if you're listening, to educate yourself, because you're already doing these type of deals. You may just not realize it.
Yeah, I appreciate that insight. So where can people find more about you?
I'm very active on LinkedIn. So if you just look me up, Brian Adams, Excelsior Capital, shoot me a note, connect. I'm happy to talk, help any way that I can. And then if you want to learn more about the company and the offerings, you can go to our website, excelsiorgp.com. And that's a great way to get started there.
So now we have the panel portion of our show. This week we have Megan Gorman. Hey, Megan.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. Good to have you on. And we also have Barb Freeberg. Hey, Barb.
Good morning, everybody. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you as well. So let's just dive right in. So Barb, you know, you're a old school real estate investor. So what did you think of the interview? What were your takeaways?
You can buy real estate in so many different ways, from just actually buying it outright for your home, for an investment, to rent out, to resell. You can buy a real estate investment trust in the public markets, or you can go with a syndication, which is a private individual like Brian Adams, who has a company who is selling shares of big buildings, commercial, industrial, in certain markets. And so there's a lot of different ways to get exposure to real estate, and they each have their pros and cons. So if you want to invest in real estate, you have to do some legwork in advance and decide, how much work do I want to do? And that's going to be a starting point. And then you have to research from there. Do I want just a quick liquid real estate investment trust? Do I want to get my hands dirty and get into the real estate markets? Do I want to find someone who is supposedly an expert and jump on the bandwagon of their investments and hopefully get a larger return? So my takeaway from this is figure out what you want and then do some analysis. And if you do decide to go with a syndication, you better make sure that you do a lot of homework to check out those opportunities, because they are less regulated typically than, say, a real estate investment trust.
I have a quick question for you about the REIT aspect of it. You know, in 2020, no big surprise, REITs got hammered. Now, they did well in the last couple months of 2020, but when I look at client performance, bonds did well last year, equities did well last year. And then we get to the REIT asset class. Most of my portfolios are about 3% REIT. So one of the things that we found during the downturn is we were obviously deploying assets from fixed income back into the equity and REIT asset class. Were you doing that during the downturn as well? Were you buying last year when REITs were down?
I typically do buy when assets are down. And so I don't like to talk about, you know, what I did specifically during certain markets, but typically I keep, like you've discussed over time, I keep a certain asset allocation, and I personally do keep a certain percentage a little bit higher than you do in real estate investment trusts, because I find they're easy and they're diversified. And yeah, they were down, and this year has been a bad year for REITs. So the question is, do you want to jump for yield and go, wow, this was bad, I'm going to look for a syndication where I can get a higher return? So the response that I have, and it's not an easy one, is, are REITs over? You know, is it because you're just buying shares in a company that owns buildings and they're not passing on the tax benefits that you might get from a syndication? The question is, should you go over to a syndication? And personally, I'm comfortable with knowing the security of REITs. I like that they're regulated. And some years, certain asset classes do better and worse. So I'm less worried that REITs had a tough year.
Can I just ask you a quick question, Barb?
Sure.
I just quickly looked up the REIT Total Return Index. And obviously, this is through last week. I couldn't grab through this week's. But REITs this year, total return is up 12. I mean, the REIT index, the MSCI US REIT index, is up 12.7% this year. So this has been a good year for REITs.
Okay.
Am I misunderstanding the data? Like, what I'm looking on my screen is, it's been a good year. So are we looking at different indices? Because, by the way, that's always a big issue. Everybody's looking at different data points.
Right. I was referring to last year.
Okay, got it. Yeah, last year was horrible. Last year was abysmal.
I was referring to last year when it was a horrible year. And
yes,
during
I'm sorry,
that,
I misunderstood.
Yeah. No problem. And so you could say, oh my gosh, REITs had a horrible year, I better get out and buy a syndicate. or I better look at real estate crowdfunding because they're promising upwards of 10%.
Or but I could just add to my REIT because it's down and I'm off my allocation target.
Exactly.
Right. And then you can be rewarded.
Exactly. And that is my answer to your initial question, Megan, which is I'm a long-term investor. I've invested already for, you know, 3+ decades. And so to say REITs had a bad year last year and syndications, ostensibly, I could have gotten higher returns. I'm not going to jump ship and say, oh, screw REITs. I'm done with them, because investing is cyclical and certain asset classes are going to have bad years and good years. And hopefully they don't all go in the same direction, because that creates a more stable return over time. So I don't say bail if REITs have a bad year. I say, like you said, Megan, put a little more money in them to keep your asset allocation in percentages that are comfortable for you over the long term, knowing that whatever asset class you invest in, whether it be international stocks, emerging markets, developed markets, large cap, small cap, mid cap, US, bonds, government bonds, some are going to have a good year, some are going to have a bad year. But overall, when markets go down, you keep your asset allocation in percentages that you're comfortable with. Overall, you'll have a reasonably decent return in line with your comfort with risk. Does that answer your question, Megan?
It does. Thank you. And I'm sorry, I got a little confused there. So I apologize.
I think one of the areas that kind of comes up a lot, the question comes up a lot. I don't think a lot of people discuss this as much, but, you know, the conversation of like syndication or, you know, through crowdfunding. I mean, those are really common questions. And I think it's going to make sense here to kind of talk a little bit about each one, because, you know, I think as investors are looking, they have to know the pros and cons of each. Barb, do you want to start with, actually, Megan, let's start with you in terms of the, because I know with some of your clients, you know, you have a lot of high net worth clients in terms of how you're investing them. So kind of what's your preference on from people with that level of wealth?
In terms of the real estate asset class, it really is very client specific. So on some ends, you know, for a lot of our client portfolios, we're just doing traditional REITs, a REIT mutual fund, a REIT ETF to give them exposure. Some clients want to get deeper into the space. And that's where we will go into the private investing world and look for funds that offer them unique opportunities. We also have clients that will find one-off projects. I've had one client in particular who's done a lot with a group that reworks buildings in the Washington, D.C. area and has had tremendous return. And then the last thing I have is I have people who own commercial real estate, and we use that to fill that bucket, right? They own land, they own beer gardens, they own car washes, and they want to use that to be their REIT allocation. So I think it's more about what does the client want to fill that bucket? Some of them have strong personal preferences, some don't. And then are we fully understanding the risk of that asset class? And a lot of people do, but I think the thing is, you know, REITs are, for the clients who are invested in just the REIT mutual funds, I find it's either boom or bust. And they have to get used to that rhythm. And that's why we usually keep the allocation low, like around 3%.
So Megan, I want to ask you something though. How would you compare the risk profile of, say, let's just say a VNQ, which is a very broad-based real estate ETF, with that of investing with a syndicator who was actually buying real estate deals and you're participating in them? Give us an idea of the risk.
I mean, I think some of the things that we talk to with clients in that is, first of all, are you looking to actually own the underlying land? Because when you are investing in a syndicate, you are directly investing in a specific property or specific properties versus owning shares of an ETF, right? And for some clients, they really like the idea of owning something. I'll give you a quick example. I have clients right now that are owning it, building that they're renovating right across the street from Harvard. It's a big, huge project going on. And they love the idea that they're directly investing to do that. You know, I think it's a couple other things. I think there's a liquidity aspect when we talk to clients. You know, if you're in the VNQ ETF, you can get liquid immediately, right? It's not a hard transaction. But a lot of these other types of investments, you're committed. You can't be half pregnant. You have to be in the investment. It would be very hard to get out. And, you know, the other negative aspect is a lot of these will require you to get a K-1, right? Depending on how it's structured, which can delay your tax return. But what a lot of them are looking for is the trade-off in returns. They feel that to some degree, when they are doing something like more direct investing in real estate or real estate syndicate, that they are going to get a higher annualized return. Now, to get a higher return, you take on more risk, you take on more of the negative aspects. But for many people, there's something tangible and visual about real estate that makes it feel a little bit different. I mean, people just don't feel as wedded to their real estate ETF. So those are the things that we talk about. It also depends, and this is sort of the weird thing about the high net worth world, it also depends on who you know. So many times I have to vet things because it's somebody's buddy that is doing this or is setting this up, right? So it's that whole friendship, affability, you know, camaraderie network that goes on that people get invited to do things with. I have to also at times be respectful of that. And part of the time, I'm the bad cop in vetting these opportunities so that the client can still be buddies with that person. So, you know, I think it just depends really on the client and the experience they want to have and that they understand the risk. But look, I've seen some of the stuff go really, really, really well. I mean, it's some of the stuff can be amazing, but it,
what
when it goes
what
south,
about
it goes
when
south
it goes
fast.
Really badly? I mean,
well, I mean,
what, what's
putting,
like, what's a worst case scenario? Because we talk about risk a lot. And in my mind, risk is two things. One, it's volatility, prices go up and down. But the other is risk is, you know, you lose a good percentage
everything.
Of your investment.
Yeah, you lose everything. And that's the question, right? The clientele I'm working with, you know, if we're dealing with this with, you know, 1% of the portfolio, and we said, if it goes to zero, how will you feel? You know, most of their answers are, look, it would really upset me, but it would not change my financial picture, right? So that's an important, I think, demarcation here, which is you have to think of it in context of it going to zero and would it cause you to lose your house or not be able to pay your bills? These people are playing with risk, but, you know, if it doesn't work out for them, it will be fine. And I think that that's, in a weird way, a little bit more freeing, right? To be able to have that analysis. So I think people have to be cautious with the risks that they take in their portfolios. The other thing to note is all of the people that I have doing things like this have pretty well built out fixed income portfolios. So they're trying to mitigate some of the risk by having lower standard deviation investments in their portfolio. And I think that's important. And then one other thing I'm going to also note is when we go to do these types of things, if we can, we try to do it in an IRA. And I bring this up because there are some IRA trustees that will allow you to own land in it, and there are a lot that don't. So I custody at Schwab, I work with Fidelity, they will not let you hold land inside your IRA. But there are specialized IRA trustees that will let you invest this way. And we like that sometimes because a lot of times with this land, you know, the income tax consequences are a little more onerous than just holding a traditional large cap mutual fund. So we're looking at it from a tax perspective. I'll give you a really quick story. I had a client, we had done a Roth conversion, and then they had an opportunity to invest in a racetrack in a European country. We did it through the Roth IRA, and they, I mean, this thing returned, it was a high risk. We vetted it and vetted it, and we told the client, look, this is either going to shoot for the fences or it's going to be a total disaster. And, you know, when you're thinking about it with Roth dollars, this is someone who basically took a very large IRA and paid all the tax on it up front. So there was the inherent risk that if this thing bombed, you know, they'd paid all the income taxes. But this thing did phenomenal. And the client felt even more clever because he did it inside a Roth IRA. So there were no tax consequences to him. But again, a lot of risk, a lot of planning, a lot of understanding all the different layers.
You're talking my language, Megan, you know, self-directed IRAs. That's
you love those.
I love that. Yeah, we do that all the time. I will ask kind of a follow-up question here because you're also the tax expert. You touched on taxes a little bit. So I want to ask kind of a more nuanced question, but I know with the self-directed IRA aspect, you know, you don't get the tax benefits of real estate that you would if you're investing outside of it. So when we're talking about the differences between REITs and syndications, crowdfunding, how do you look at it from a tax perspective? That's a huge part of why people invest in real estate.
Look, I mean, just for anyone's traditional portfolio, right? You're looking at just adding a REIT to your portfolio. If you can, if you don't need to be living off the income from it, IRAs are a great place to put just your traditional REIT because the income coming off of it is typically not at preferential tax rates. When we get into the more complicated investments, we have to look at it and figure out where net-net they will be better served. For a lot of clients, they do want to receive some of the tax benefits, but it sounds weird, but at this level, some of the tax benefits don't even really matter, right? It's there, and the clients focus more on the return. If it's something unique, right, that's when we turn to the IRA. So like this whole racetrack thing, and this person was a finance person. So it's not like I was dealing with a creative who didn't run numbers. We were running numbers, he was running numbers, and we all felt the potential upside because the risk was so high on this thing that the potential for return was so high, he felt he was better served doing it in the IRA. So it's by an investment by investment basis. And sometimes you don't have a choice. I mean, sometimes it has to invest wherever it invests. I mean, I've put stuff in IRAs before because we can't do it somewhere else. It's just not possible. It's just dependent on the individual situation.
You know, when you're investing in real estate in an IRA, it really just comes down to running the numbers. It's not always black and white. You know, there's things like you said, like REITs that are probably best in an IRA because you're not getting the preferential tax treatment. But, you know, when it comes to actual property, it does make sense to run the numbers because sometimes you don't have a choice. I think with a lot of people, choice is based on where their assets are, right? So if you've got like 70% of your net worth in an IRA, then most likely real estate's going to be in the IRA because that's where the money is. So I totally agree with that. Barb, so what about you? I mean, I know you've invested in real estate in the past, and I don't know if you've done commercial real estate or have you kind of ever explored that as an asset versus rental property?
My experience spans owning real estate, flipping real estate, and owning REITs. So I have never invested up to this point in a syndication, nor in real estate crowdfunding. It's not because I don't think it's any good, but I've just been lazy. Okay, put it out there. Investing in crowdfunding and syndications requires a lot of work. They've grown in popularity since the 2010 Jobs Act, where the laws have changed, making these more accessible to regular individuals. I have a couple of points to make. One is, if you have some time and energy and you don't want to invest in your own buying and selling real estate, flipping apartment buildings and stuff, I would say, I want to address here because Megan works with a high net worth crowd, but I suspect all of our listeners are not in that group. We've got people here that are maybe just getting started. So if you want to tap into real estate and you want to look at crowdfunding for non-accredited investors, that means people that aren't super wealthy, then you might want to look at some of the new crowdfunding opportunities. And I'm not saying they're good or they're bad, but just that they're out there. And you can possibly get a chance to actually have direct ownership in real estate deals with really, really small amounts of money. So if you just Google non-accredited real estate crowdfunding, you're going to get lists of different companies that are now presenting these opportunities for small investors from anywhere from $10 minimum investments on up to $500, $1,000 to get in. And you may find greater opportunities. You may find some of the tax benefits that you wouldn't ordinarily get with a REIT. So back to your original question, what have I invested in? Part of the decision to invest in crowdfunding and in the syndications are you really do need to do some vetting in advance. and find out who's running the company. What is the greatest loss that I might experience? Am I comfortable leaving my money tied up for 5 to 10 years? Because from every single research I've done, for every bit of research that I've done into these syndications and crowdfunding, the majority of them require your money is tied up. So you have to be comfortable with that. So wrapping it up for me in this whole spectrum, there is so much opportunity to get into real estate investing. I believe real estate is a really good asset class, but it is up to you to figure out where you want to get your real estate portion of your portfolio returns from.
One thing I do want to get into talking about the types of real estate, but one thing I want to talk about, because I think it's really timely, is the actual state of the market. Now, I know, Megan, you've recently sold a piece of property, and I want to kind of talk a little bit about your experience and what you're seeing, because I think it's reflective of what's going on in the market in general.
Yeah. I mean, if you ask me what I spend most of my time on right now is real estate. I got clients buying everywhere, and most markets are frenetic. You know, the experience I just had is my husband and I, we have our primary residence. We had spent 10 years in it. We've decided to make some changes. So first of all, we interviewed a number of different realtors. And I don't know if other people do this when they sell their houses, but you know, I think chemistry and strategy is so important. And we basically had a game plan go on the market and to maximize this frenzy, right? So in the market I'm in, the strategy is you underprice to push the bidding war up. And it was very hard for my husband and I to underprice the house for what we did. We knew what we wanted to get for it. But before the house even went live, we had an all-cash offer with a two-week close. And this all-cash offer concept, two-week close, is going on all over the country, right? So if you're somebody who needs financing, it's frustrating because the realtors want the all-cash offers. I will tell you that you can buy a house for all cash and you have 90 days to add a mortgage to it. That is possible. And so before we even went live, we had an offer. We went back and forth with them. And then we decided we wanted to wait for offer day. So we turned them down. In retrospect, it was incredibly strategic because they came back with an even bigger offer and they ended up getting the house. So we were on the market for 3 days technically, but our buyers had us in their sight before we went live. But I will tell you, I'm in the industry. I'm used to doing this with clients. So I could determine where we were in the process, how we should react. And the realtors were very appreciative. My husband doesn't deal with real estate every day, although he does do M&A work. But it was very hard because he just looks at it differently. And so I think what's going on in the market is we've got a lot of frenzy going on. And buyers, I mean, I feel like it's the great tulip bulb situation in Holland. Not that I think the housing market's going to crash, but I think a lot of people are going to wake up in 3, 6, 12 months and wonder what they bought just because it gets so frenzied. And I'm seeing it in markets from Bend, Oregon to Colorado to, you know, Texas, Florida, you know, Brooklyn, Southampton. It's just crazy right now. And so I think the thing is, my takeaway is unless you're a seller or you really have to buy, I don't know if I would jump in this market right now. I'm very serious about it because I think it's a complex market that is overwhelming. And I don't know if we make good decisions in the frenzy. And I'll say one last thing, which was we had turned down the offer initially when the buyer came to us, partly because we felt it was so frenzied that our decision-making process, we didn't feel comfortable. But I could see that if we had to sell the house or if we needed a certain price, why people would just capitulate and take the offer. It's a very emotional experience. It's very hard. And, you know, I've been walking clients through it. You know, I'll give you a quick example. I had clients call me last week and they're like, we found a great house. It's on the market for 1.5 in California. That's a decent price range. And I said, great, it's going to sell for 2.1. And they said, how do you know? Our realtor told us the same thing. I said, I know this market. I said, well, show me the house. They show it to me, 2-bedroom, 1-bath, San Francisco with a brick foundation. And I said, okay, first of all, and it hadn't been renovated in 80 years. I said, first of all, you have a brick foundation. I don't know if I can get you insured because I think you're going to have to go retrofit. by the way, the kitchen, that's a $250,000 renovation. That's how much kitchens cost to renovate in San Francisco at this level. I was like, you have one bathroom and you have children. Like, no, this is a disaster for you to buy. And it was hard because I had to basically break their hearts about this cute little house that they had fallen in love with. But I don't think I was wrong in telling them this, because I think you have to have that voice of reason in the process. And they didn't buy the house. And I think that they saved themselves a lot of heartache.
One thing that you forgot, Montana. Montana is one of those markets too. Yeah,
Montana is huge. It is. It's crazy.
Some of those pieces of real estate have gone up like 100% in the last like 2 years. And it's just Californians coming in with money and just saying, hey, look, it's cheap. I can buy something near a mountain. And what's the term? Irrational exuberance? I mean,
Yes.
I look at this here because it's the same here in Boston, and it's a seller's market. It's hard because you never want to be buying in a seller's market. I mean, it's been like that for years, where it's all cash offers, it's no contingencies. And I'll get to you in a minute, Barb, but because I know you've got a lot of experience in this, but you know, you got all cash offers, no contingencies. I mean, that's such a high risk endeavor. And you're trying to compete and people here are writing letters to the seller like, oh, poor me, please pick me. I mean, the fact that, you know, writing a letter makes any difference and that just the monetary aspect is not enough. Like to me, that just smells of desperation. And that's not a market I want to play in. The problem is it's great if you can sell a property and jump into that market, but then you have to go buy another one. So it's really hard. I mean, we were looking at a property last year and, you know, I was kind of negotiating with the seller at the time. And I told a friend of mine, I said, yeah, we're just negotiating. I'm kind of playing it out. And he's like, where's the property? Like above a gas station? Like, where are you negotiating with the seller right now? So it was,
yeah.
I mean, it was funny because it was a unique property. So it wasn't for everybody, but for us, it was perfect.
Well, you know, it's crazy, Kirk, because I would have said the letters don't matter. The woman who really wanted my house, I was able to Google her, right? And find out about her. And I was looking at all the buyers. And it got to a point where I really wanted her to get the house because I knew she was like me, a career woman and with no kids. And the house is a unique house. It's been designed a very distinct way. It's an entertainer's house. And I knew she'd love the house the same as I would, right? Like I knew that my love for this house, I know she's going to take care of it the way. We didn't make the decision based on that, but in me, when we finally picked her, I was like, oh, I'm so glad because I know she's going to love this house. So yeah. It's corny, the letter thing, but it does sort of get at you.
No, it does. I mean, it's humanizing the experience, right? It's not just a transaction, but you're humanizing it. I mean, the buying real estate is an emotional decision. Well, I should say it can be. I mean, for most people, there's an emotional decision part of that process. It's not just about the numbers, because if it was about the numbers, we wouldn't be in the situation to begin with. So, you know, a lot of it's emotional. So I think that's a great point. So, Barb, what about you? I mean, you're a seasoned real estate investor. You've seen lots of booms and busts. I mean, what does this feel like? You know, from a buyer's and seller's perspective, like when we see stuff like this, what does this feel like? And in your experience, like what is the kind of ending result here?
It feels very out of whack. And I echo everything you all have been saying. It feels like there is a lack of reason and that bidding up properties so high with so little inventory and so many buyers is just fraught with risk. And the possibility that at some point there's going to come an equilibrium, which means the market may be in a bubble. I can't say if it is or if it isn't, but I'm extremely conservative. I don't like to overpay for anything. And I think if you don't have to buy now, I would just wait. And I think of this not only with real estate, but I also think of it a little bit with the stock market. Now, for example, are stocks as highly valued as they were in 1999 before the tech crash? No. But when assets get so expensive and you're paying so much money for smaller and smaller amounts of value, you have to ask yourself, do you want to go with the, and I hesitate to say this, but I'm going to say it anyhow. Do you want to go with a bigger fool theory in that you're just going to pay and pay and pay because everyone else is in the market and you don't want to miss out? or do you want to just sit back for a little while? It's okay to do nothing. It's okay to sit there and wait for things to get back to an equilibrium. And my personal experience right now is there are so many investments that are pulling at us as if we've got to do something. We've got to invest in Bitcoin. We have to invest in real estate. The stock market can only go up. Well, after decades and decades of investing, that is not true. At some point, markets reverse. Real estate, stock market, cryptocurrency, everything. There are ups and downs. And it's okay to do nothing. It's okay to pile up a certain amount of cash if you don't want to pay for tremendous valuations, which mean pay for assets that are very expensive when evaluated according to historical standards. So I do think we're hitting a bubble across a lot of different market categories. That doesn't mean they're going to reverse and crash tomorrow. It could be another 2-3 years. So nobody knows the future, but don't get swept up into buying based on frenzy.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And just for reference, as Barb was saying, I mean, 4 years ago, people were talking about how it was a lot of real estate in certain areas, like in secondary or tertiary markets, were getting a little bubble-ish. So, you know, just for reference, like you never pick the top. I mean, Megan mentioned tulips, which I think is funny because there's so many markets out there that feel like it's a tulip bubble right now. You know, some of these things like NFTs and cryptocurrencies are feeling that way. So I think it's really important to realize like you're never going to be able to pick the top, like unless you're extremely lucky, like nobody can pick the top. But, you know, it's important to at least be mindful. And this is where, as Megan said earlier, liquidity comes in. So what Barbara's saying is keep some cash aside. And I think you have to find a balance. You have to find a balance between investing now versus saving some for later. Liquidity is important because if you're going to invest in times like this, where it's a little bit bubble-ish, you want to be able to have the liquidity to get out as needed so you're not riding it all the way down. Now, if you're a buy and hold real estate investor and you're never going to sell it, you know, it probably doesn't really matter much, but as long as you're buying it at a good price. But generally speaking, real estate's illiquid and you need to buy right. So, you know, I think it's really important to do your research. We're going to move on to kind of wrap up the show here. But, you know, I think all of this is really important because I've been seeing a lot of expanded interest into real estate lately, more so than normal. And I think people are feeling left out. And it's really important to just be mindful of how your emotions are playing into this and that they're not controlling you. Because if you feel like you're getting FOMO, that's probably the time you should step back and just say, hold on, let me think this through rationally. Because FOMO is a really strong feeling. And it's causing people to boost up some of these cryptocurrencies and some of these stocks that I would argue are probably worthless, but, you know, going up hundreds and hundreds of percent for irrational reasons. So I think it's really important to be mindful of how your emotions are directing your investing behaviors. So final thoughts, Megan, and where can people find more about you?
Look, I think from an investment standpoint, I think a REIT allocation in the portfolio is always warranted. And like all things with asset allocation, as asset classes perform, we trim and reallocate. And if asset classes dip, we want to be reallocating into those asset classes. And I think if you do that with a REIT allocation, you'll be well served. But when it comes to actually owning real estate, especially in this market, take a step back, really think through, should you be jumping through this market? Is there a reason to be engaged in this marketplace? Like me, it could be that you need to sell your house and that's the situation, or you need to buy a house. If you're just feeling like, as you mentioned, Kirk, the FOMO, I'd let this market play out a bit. I think opportunities will continue to come up as we all shift our living patterns coming out of pandemic. So I'm Megan Gorman. You can find me on the Forbes site or on Twitter at Megan_E_Gorman. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on, Megan. And Barb, final thoughts from you.
I echo what's been said during the show with one addition. It's not a bad idea to invest a small amount of money every month into a diversified investment portfolio. And that's called dollar cost averaging. And if you're participating in a 401k, you're doing that already. So my key takeaways are be diversified. Don't get swept up in a frenzy. You don't have to do anything else other than just keep a diversified asset allocation, invest a certain amount every month, and over the long term, your assets will grow. But by investing a certain percentage every month and investing a specific dollar amount every month, you are automatically buying fewer shares when prices are high and more shares when prices are lower. So with that, you can find me. I'm Barbara Friedberg at Robo Advisor Pros and Barbara Friedberg Personal Finance, as well as on YouTube. Thank you for having me, Kirk. See you next week.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Barb. That's the show for this week. Thanks again for joining us on Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, Wealth Manager of Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on this show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on the podcast app of your choosing. You can also check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. On the website, you'll have access to all our resources, show notes, and archive shows. Lastly, please leave show rating and comment on the podcast app of your choice. When you subscribe and rate the show, it allows us to get better access to some of the top guests that you're going to want to hear. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.